Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Kat, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club. We're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear a speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And tonight, I'm going to get a friend of mine to introduce our speaker. So, Shannon, if you would come on up.
Hi, I'm Shannon. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm introducing Ellen tonight. I've known Ellen for a little over 3 years. Met her at my home group at the river, and it's been really cool to see her grow throughout these years. And I just remember when she first came in, I think she was a little bit nervous to share and get involved, but she's actually kind of helped me get out of my shell and introduced me to new meetings and service work. And I'm really looking forward to what she has to share with us tonight. And with that, I give you Ellen.
Hi, my name is Ellen. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a little bit nervous. I'm not a professional at doing this speaking, and, this is just for me. I'm not representing AA. This is just from my heart. So I was always told that it's good to open up with a joke. I don't do jokes very well, so let's go with it. A pirate walks into a bar with a paper towel on his head. And the bartender says, "Why do you have a paper towel on your head?" And the pirate says, "Arr, I've got a bounty on me head." So that's my lame attempt. Thank you, Tim, for asking me to tell my story, and thank you all for being here tonight. And I hope I haven't offended any pirates in the audience. You know, I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And if you're anything like me, you know, as I talk tonight, you might rotate in your chair a little bit. You might mentally keep your distance and think, geez, she's nothing like me. Or she didn't go through any of the things I went through. But, you know, I never liked being told what to do. And if you're here because you had to do it for a court order, or you're told because you should be here, and you're feeling a little bit angry, you know, I can really relate. There are a lot of times I would come to a meeting and I would feel so distanced. I would be just in my own head and rarely hear what was being talked about. But somebody told me early on to try to find the similarities in stories and what people share, because if I focused on the differences, I would difference myself right out the door. You know, this disease wants to kill me, and it will go to any lengths to do it. My sobriety date is November 28, 2012. I was a hopeless and suicidal alcoholic. Today, I'm here to celebrate 2 years as a member of AA. You know, I walked into AA a couple of weeks after I started after I quit drinking. Actually, the treatment program that I was in told me that I had to go to meetings. And, you know, never in my wildest dreams did I think I would end up here. In fact, when I started that treatment program and they told me that they were a 12-step based program and that I had to attend AA meetings, I kind of went, what? You know, they asked me if I'd ever gone to AA. I said, no, it's all about God. God, that's not going to work for me. I thought I was kind of licked. But, you know, I was so beat down at that point. I was so sick. I was so out of my mind. I had kind of gotten to that point where I just didn't have much fight left in me, at least on that particular day. So I started coming to AA meetings. My first meeting was a beginner's meeting at Skyline. Before I went, I spent a lot of time looking at the directory. I didn't want to attend a meeting that was in my neighborhood. I thought I might see neighbors, you know. But honestly, I've gone to a lot of meetings now in my neighborhood. I never see my neighbors. They might need to be there. I don't know. But I was really guilt-ridden. I was remorseful. I don't think I even looked up. I think I stared at the floor, stared at my lap. I just really couldn't believe I had ended up in AA. I felt like my life was over. I felt like I had had to give up my best friend, which was alcohol. And I didn't know how to live without it. I just kind of barely hung on to life without drinking. It was down to minute by minute almost. But, you know, I walked into that meeting. I was so wound up. I was so anxious. I felt like my heart was pounding on my chest. And, you know, a lot of people would rightfully call that fear. I just said I was anxious. I don't remember much about the meeting or what was said. I didn't really understand the rhythm of the meeting or the things that were read. And I found it really embarrassing to raise my hand and say I was the newcomer and that my name was Ellen. And I honestly, I couldn't get a whole lot out without starting to cry. But, you know, I do remember right after that meeting calling that same friend who said, try to find the similarities. And I said, wow, I think I have 25 new friends tonight. And 15 of them gave me their phone numbers. It was really great. I was really shocked at how I felt after that meeting. It was not the fear and anxiety. It was, wow, maybe this will work. It was overwhelming. You know, I had become a drunken recluse. I didn't hang around people. But it was overwhelming in a good way. But, you know, my life didn't just turn around just because I went to an AA meeting. I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. I'm kind of jumping ahead. Let me give you a little bit of my background. I was born in Birmingham, Alabama. My parents were nice people. They didn't drink. They lived a modest life. We lived in a small house in the suburbs. My dad was real sweet, very introverted. My mom was artistic and a little high-strung. I'm the third of four children. I've got an older sister, older brother, and I have got a younger brother who's profoundly disabled. He looked normal but didn't talk, and he sometimes screamed and beat his head. He did not attend school. There wasn't a school for him. The neighborhood kids would ride their bikes around in a circle in front of the house and yell, retard. And, of course, I went out and tried to beat them all up. We were that family on the street that had problems. I spent a lot of time playing in the woods by myself. I was happy that way. You know, my older siblings, they were starting to get into trouble. They were starting to get into alcohol and drugs and teenage stuff, you know. And they had this little thing, don't tell the parents. Secrecy was kind of the code in our family. You know, I did okay in school. I did fairly well until about junior high, and that's when, about that time, I started finding other things, you know. It was also right about that time that my mom had what was called a nervous breakdown, and that's what they called it back then. Sounds kind of pretty. It was actually really scary. She heard people talking to her through the car radio, telling her to throw away everything we had. You know, out went the Christmas ornaments, out went food, out went just everyday things. China. I remember I thought that the garbage men each week were kind of going, yay, wow, what's going to be there this week? She eventually went to a hospital for a while, but before she went, I ran away from home. And I would stay with the succession of friends until my welcome wore thin, and then I'd move on. Eventually, I came back. My dad was real sad. Mom eventually came home from the hospital, and we all kind of walked on eggshells for a while. But you know what? None of that made me an alcoholic. Yeah, you know, but it was when, about that time, that alcohol and boys all started to work for me. I'm going to stick to talking to you about alcohol. That's what our program's about. But, of course, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and there was lots of other stuff. And, of course, I always said yes. I never did the Nancy Reagan just say no. You know, just like the big book says, in the doctor's opinion, I drank because I liked the effect produced by alcohol. I drank differently than my friends did. They could have one or two, couple more than that, but they'd stop. Me, I always drank until I, you know, passed out, blacked out. I thought I was better at drinking than they were. You know, at this point in time, other kids, they're in sports, right? They're into cheerleading or band or whatever, church maybe even. But me, I was kind of on the periphery. I thought everybody else was a dork. And I really just wanted to grow up and get out. It's right about this time, too, that I kind of made a half-hearted attempt at suicide. I drank a whole bottle of Boone's Farm and took a bunch of pills, and all that got me was very, very sick and puking my guts out. It was nasty. You know, but why did I do that? You know, what did I like? And, you know, why did I could never figure anything out. You know, what made me happy? What did I think would fix me? I knew there was something wrong. I just had no clue. Alcohol made me feel better. Boys and searching for love made me feel better. You know, I'd work my little feminine ways, get those guys all wrapped around my finger. And then when I got them, it was like, oops, it's like a fish on a hook. I was like, oh, how quick can I get rid of you? You know, I'd have that typical breakup conversation. It's me, not you. And, you know, what's really funny is that's really true. It really was me. I was expelled from high school. You know, I was a kid with A's and B's, and I'm expelled from high school because of other substances. And I was not allowed to return until I went to see a shrink or a priest, so of course I went to see a shrink. You know, my dad's on the Board of Education at this time. It was not pretty at home. You know, I had all the encounters with police and bunged up cars, and I was just adrift. I had no clue. I did manage, though, to get into college, although I had little direction. I stayed there way too long. I'd work part-time, I'd go to school. But alcohol was really starting to take its toll, and I had a tough time getting out of college. But eventually did, I got a job, and ended up getting married to somebody who did all the same things I did. He was a preacher's son. I should have known better. We got divorced a few years later, and my alcohol abuse just continued to get worse. You know, I think looking back on it, I always got away with a lot. You know, I didn't get locked up. And I think it's just because of the way I look. Do I look like an alcoholic? From the outside, I always pretended everything was fine. If anybody ever did ask, you know, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. But, you know, pretty soon I actually met a nice guy, and we started dating, and after one night where we went out and I drank the way I liked to drink, he told me, hey, my dad's an alcoholic. I think you're one too, and I can't be with you if you're going to act that way. So I said I could change, and I did. I stopped drinking for a little while for him. You know, the big book talks about different types of drinkers, you know, moderate or even hard drinkers, and who can give up drink if there's a sufficiently strong reason, you know, like love. Well, I'm that typical example. You know, we ended up getting married. I got a stepson along with it. So a whole little family. And there were several years where I did not drink. But it didn't last. You know, I heard somebody say this one time. I don't know when I changed from being a hard drinker to being an alcoholic, but I'm pretty sure I was drunk at the time. That describes me completely. You know, but I still worked. I tried to work hard. I think I was really trying to be somebody through work. Work was really the only place that I felt like maybe I could succeed. And I started traveling for work. And for me, that was just an alcoholic's paradise because I could drink and get away with it for the most part. You know, but drinking, it all started to interfere with work and how I performed. And before long, you know, I did what I swore I'd never do. I started to take a little nip in the morning before I went to work just to get through the day. When I came home on the weekends from those trips, you know, I tried to make excuses for why I was drinking so much. You know, I couldn't go to a party without tanking up in advance. You know, I really needed more than other people. And it was really sad to be knee-walking drunk way too early in the evening before anybody else was even starting to feel it. And, of course, I started to hide alcohol all around the house. I'm sneaking drinks. I'm doing anything I can to keep my buzz on, you know. And I started thinking about suicide because my life really was becoming unmanageable. But I just kept on drinking. You know, hiding, sneaking, using our money for drinking, my dishonesty, it was my life. And I was really sick. I was becoming physically sick. I was mentally sick. And I was covered with these big bruises all the time that I could not explain. Because I couldn't stay standing up after I started drinking. And I kept getting caught. You know, it just seemed like I would spend so much time finding the perfect hiding place. And I'd wake up the next day and that empty bottle would be sitting on a table. It was like a little solitary soldier saying, "I know what you did." It was my husband's way of saying, "You can't get away with this, but I'm not going to have a knockdown, drag-out fight with you." I hated that. I hated those questions of, why do you do this to yourself? Why do you drink like that? What have you gotten into? Are you drunk? Of course, I didn't know. I honestly didn't know why I did it, but I kept doing it. At one point, I knew I was an alcoholic. I absolutely, to my core, knew. I had figured out also that once I took that first drink, I couldn't stop drinking. I'd try to stop, and I'd always start back again. But I always kept drinking, and I'd drink to blackout, you know, nearly every single night. I got to the point where my motto in life was, life sucks, you suffer, and then you die. Life just totally seemed futile to me. I didn't know how to get out of it. I had dug a huge hole, and I didn't know how to get out. So what happened? So I knew my life was unmanageable. I kept saying, I would fix it. I'll do it. I'll change. I'd look at treatment programs on the internet, and the minute I saw the word God on anything, I'd say, oop, that's not for me. And then we had a nephew who came to live with us, and he brought with us the entire content of a bar from his parents' house. And I'd always kind of tried to stick to beer or wine at home. I drank hard liquor on the road, and I knew that was what made me crazy fast. But boy, there was a lot of liquor in what he brought. So I started sneaking little drinks out of it here and there and out of his stash. And I just kept trying to drink just the right amount so that I could maintain, so that I could still fix dinner at night. I always overshot. You know, and it, It was pretty quickly. I just didn't care anymore. And I was knee-walking drunk at 10 a.m. in the morning. It wasn't pretty. You know, the alcoholic life that I had tried to hide, that I had tried to keep a dirty little secret that just my husband and I knew, it wasn't a secret anymore. It seemed to be a big brouhaha, at least that's the way I remember it. And it was like the gig was up. I had to admit I couldn't quit drinking and I could not fix it. And I finally agreed to enter a treatment program. You know, looking back on it, treatment gave me a great place, a place to sober up. But, you know, talking about my feelings and the feeling wheel and going to group therapy, I knew that wasn't going to keep me sober. I saw a lot of people in that treatment program drop out. There was a high rate of relapse after people got out. And I was scared. I was really scared about relapse. I didn't want to do that. I had spent so long being unhappy. I saw this tiny little glimmer that there might be another way of life. I just didn't want to relapse. So this is where I come into Skyland. And I started going to AA meetings a couple of times a week while I was in treatment. Once I finished treatment, it was really scary to leave it, but I knew it was time. You know, I'd gotten comfortable, I knew the people, I knew the routine. I had no clue what was going to happen. And so, you know, you hear 90 meetings in 90 days, and so I tried to put together my schedule of here are the meetings I'm going to go to. And I tried a lot of different meetings. I had built this kind of personal rule that I would go to a meeting at least twice. If I didn't like it, you know, maybe the problem was me and not the meeting. So let's try it again. Let's see how it works. And then I realized pretty quickly on that I had to stop counting 90 and 90 because all I was doing was counting. And I really just needed to be going to meetings. And I ended up going to meetings nearly a meeting a day for a year, with pretty few exceptions. You know, I would go to meetings. I'm a little socially awkward, and I'm not very good at maintaining conversations or starting conversations with people, but I found that I could ask another woman for a recommendation on a meeting to go to, and it was a great conversation starter. And I got a lot of recommendations. You know, it was suggested that I call other women, ask them how their day was. You know, it was really hard for me to even ask for phone numbers, but I tried to get over myself. I was told to get a sponsor. Man, that was really, really hard because I felt like I was asking another woman out for a date. Not like there's anything wrong with that. There isn't. But for me, it felt really weird. And then, you know, of course, my sponsor told me I had to call her every day. And I'm not a disciplined person. I'm an alcoholic. And that was really hard. You know, I was told to get a home group and recommended to get a job in my home group. And then early on, a friend of mine asked me if I wanted to go to a convention with her, and AA convention. And I said yes. And it was pretty overwhelming to be in this convention with about 1,000 other people in AA. But I could really relate to the stories that I heard. And it was very strange to me because in that convention, I'm less than 2 months sober, but over and over again, I heard in that convention stories that said, everything you need is in the big book. Everything you need is in the first 164 pages. There is a solution. It's all right there. Up until that point, I hated the big book. I mean, I absolutely did. It seemed like women were an afterthought. We're either wives or mothers, you know. God's mentioned every other sentence. You know, chapter 4, we agnostics. I'm sorry, I just thought it was a bunch of contradictory hullabaloo. You know, there is a God. God is everything or he is nothing. I mean, seriously, what does that mean? Selfishness, self-centeredness, ego. Me? I do so many things for other people. I am not self-centered. I can actually point out the guy who's self-centered. I can see him in every meeting. I know who he is. It's not me. And honesty, I'm an honest person. I tell you the truth, except if you ask me where I hid my booze or if I was drunk or... And fears, I'm not a fear. I'm not a fearful person. I am not afraid of anything or anybody. It's the way I was raised. Being self-sufficient, not needing anybody for anything or any help, that's how I knew how to live my life. But you know what? That 164 pages thing stuck in my head. And I read the big book with my sponsor. And, you know, I don't know how anybody can do this program without a sponsor. Because when I read the big book, man, I picked it apart. I already told you that. Hated everything. And you know, but when I read it with my sponsor, it was totally different. And I realized that I just had other words for things, you know. Instead of having fears, I had anxiety. Instead of self-centeredness and ego, I had pride. I thought pride was a good thing. Well, I kind of twisted it around and it becomes a bad thing. And my go-to emotion for nearly everything was just anger. You know, it took me a while. The first time it was suggested that I write a gratitude list, I think I growled and said, are you kidding me? I have nothing to be grateful for. I honestly could not think of anything. It was spoon-fed to me, bit by bit. That's kind of sad. I wrote down all those little things that were spoon-fed to me. In my heart, I was still kind of dead, though. But I started to work the steps with my sponsor, and although I wasn't sure I was doing anything right or that I even understood it, I just kept trying. I wanted to move forward. And, you know, when it came to getting down on our knees to say the third step prayer, I did it, and I did not burst into flames, nor did my head rotate around like in The Exorcist. Which I really thought it would. God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. Pretty powerful. You know, I thought the big book's description of a psychic change was like this blinding white light and God and, you know, I actually found out that the psychic change was for me being able to accept help, to listen, to follow suggestions, and to just try to be honest. But, you know, life kept coming. It didn't stop. 2 months sober, my department at work was closed and I lost my job. I went to a meeting and I remember tearfully sharing, I'm just trying to get sober. Can I work on just one thing at a time? No. Didn't work that way. My father-in-law passed away at 7 months sober, and then my dad died 3 weeks later. But I was able to be there. I was sober and with grace and dignity along with my siblings. 5 months later, my mom fell and had a stroke and died. I held her hand and said goodbye. And I got through the 12th step with my sponsor. Just so that I could continue to live them daily now. So, what is it like now? You know, I now know I'm just a garden variety drunk. I'm just an example of the progressive nature of alcoholism. You know, we get worse, never better. I still go to a meeting nearly every day. If I can't, three or four, that's about the minimum. Otherwise, I start to get really squirrely. I start to think kind of odd thoughts. I still go to conventions, and I sign up early for them. I don't think, oh, maybe I should wait till the last minute. And I actually volunteer to do things at them that I think other people probably don't want to do, like hospitality. Not because I'm good at it, but I think I ought to do it. I try. I have a job in my home group now. I wash coffee pots. I also volunteered to be my home group's intergroup rep, which is the group that supports the Atlanta Central Office. You know, that phone number that you call. You know, the ninth step promise talks about God doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. For me, that's the AA's program and my sponsor. I call my sponsor and I try to be honest about what I'm feeling and doing, and hopefully I'm asking for help before I do something and not after. You know, so how did I get over the God thing? Well, I kind of came to peace about it. It's just three letters. I'm still not sure what God is or what it's not. And when I think about it too hard, I lose all spirituality completely. But I do know I'm not running the show. And the truth is, I don't make the sun come up, and there are a lot of really cool things that do happen in the universe, and I don't know why it all happens. I think I'm more of a universe kind of gal than a God kind of gal, but God's a lot shorter to say than universe. I also found out that prayer can be really simple. It doesn't have to be perfect or even precise. I just have to say, God, I don't know. Please help me. I found out through my fourth and fifth steps that I have a few key things that make me tick and make me ticked off. These ticks and defects, these less positive aspects of my personality, my shortcomings, they tend to pop out when I'm stressed. You know that HALT thing, the hungry, angry, lonely, tired? I always add a S on the end for sick. That's really true. You know, I can get really crazy really fast when I pull an all-nighter for work or if I'm not feeling good. So I have to be careful in that regard. I still don't like to be told what to do. And with every new boss at work, I start to act out a little bit. But at least now I recognize it. I try to talk to my sponsor. I try to pray. And I try to tell myself that that spring inside me that's getting really tight, it's caused by me. Not my boss. Not anything he said. Not anything he did. It's all about me. When there is a problem, it really is me. You know, my shortcomings, my defects, I wish God would just take them all away. But that's not how it works. I learned I can't run out and make all of my amends, just like in the movies. You know, they make everything good in about 5 minutes, and then they get to the rest of the movie. I found I have to really think about, what was my part? What did I do? And I have to stick on my side and really apologize honestly, and ask for forgiveness, and then just listen and shut up. They don't always turn out like I think they will. For the most part, they're pretty good, though. And I cry like a baby after every single one. Step 10, I just try to do all the steps every day. That's what step 10 is to me. Just repeat. You know, just like that, just the rinse cycle. Rinse and repeat. Repeat. And if I'm wrong, I promptly admit it. 11 and 12, you know, I try to pray and meditate daily. I read AA literature. I try to work the steps in all my affairs with my dog, with the little spider that landed in front of me. I try with everything and everybody. and including myself, because, you know, sometimes I have to apologize to myself. I need to ask for forgiveness. I have to ask for forgiveness from myself, because I'm only human and I do make mistakes. I do sponsor other women, and I ask God to just give me the right words so that I might help somebody else. And I try to get myself out of the equation. You know I have but a daily reprieve from alcoholism. And it is contingent upon the maintenance of my spiritual condition. Pretty big stuff coming from me. You know, every day is a new beginning. And it no longer has to be the alcoholic nightmare that I repeated every day. You know, AA is a great way of life that I could have never dreamed of before. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a good story.
I've asked Marilyn to come up and hand out the chips, please, ma'am, at the last minute.
I am Marilyn. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Marilyn.
And we have our chip system, which marks our time in recovery. The white chip is our surrender chip to start a new way of life. Just 24 hours, one night. Yes, ma'am. Yay! That feels good, all the clapping. I know how it did when I got my white chip. Anyone else want to try just for tonight, for one day?
While others live in high, a big piece of the pie, so many they got it wrong. As for me, when I wanted too much, ain't never enough. Myself, hide it from everyone else, save it for a rainy day. If you wanna have it all the time, gotta give it away. All I had be love, kept it on. If you want love all the time, give it to someone else. I want everyone around to see how much your love means to me. Baby, wear it on my sleeve. It'll never leave if I give it and just the